Welcome to Technology Tangents. We get leaders together to discuss the important tech of today and the implications for tomorrow. Our discussions are fun, lighthearted, and frankly opinionated, but hopefully it gives you a sense of what matters, what to pay attention to, and what to ignore. With me, as always, is Jason Goth, Credera's CTO. Welcome, Jason.
Good morning, Vincent.
How are you today?
Great.
Awesome. Glad to hear it. And joining us for this special occasion, returning from the previous episode, Kevin Erickson. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you guys for having me back again.
Apparently, the populace did not revolt when we had you on last time, and so you were permitted back this time. Don't mess with them. Well, listen, we finished up CES earlier this year. I want to talk a little bit about that just to kick us off here. And I want to be a little bit provocative, just fair warning, health warning, if you will. Frankly, it had been a dream of mine for many years now to go to CES, basically ever since I got into technology, which was a minute ago. And I had never been before, so I was pretty excited to see sort of what was the latest, greatest, newest, coolest tech that will be coming out in a decade from now. But I could try today as a participant at CES. And if I'm being honest, I was disappointed. It was not at all what I thought it would be. Attendance was actually quite good. I mean, we're back to like 115,000, roughly double what we had last year. If you recall, in 2021, they had turned off all people in person and did just virtual. So it was a sort of slow ramp, but there were a lot of people for sure. The cab lines were crazy again. Ubers were impossible to get. But the real issue was not any of that. It was that the technology there was very iterative. It was very incremental. There was things that I had thought were very obvious as sort of next steps, and they're good next steps. Don't get me wrong. We're starting to like actually integrate a lot of different technology back into things that are actually useful. So rather than just having some Alexa that does something bizarre and listens to you, and maybe you could have a fun conversation on your phone, it's actually integrated into devices now. You can ask questions like, what's in my fridge or what's on my grocery list? Things like this, where it's getting the data from the refrigerator that has some camera in it that's using some object detection to figure out what items you have and what items you don't have and filling in a list, and all these nice integration layers are finally taking place. But while that's all very good for the end consumer and things that you probably do want to buy from that perspective, it's pretty disappointing in my mind from CES that's really supposed to be at the next wave of innovation. Don't get me wrong, there were some cool things. For example, my favorite was Caterpillar had a really cool display. You showed up and it was just like the cockpit of a fighter jet. So you hop in this booth and there are screens all around you and these joysticks, and you actually get to drive a real life dozer that was out in Arlington, Virginia or someplace like this. I don't know where it was. And another booth where you could drive actually use an excavator. And so they had cameras set up, so it's just like the real thing, and you're really driving this piece of equipment in real time across the country. So that's pretty amazing and pretty powerful, like a lot of what you've seen in the movies of what Air Force people do nowadays with these unmanned drones. But that was basically it. And again, like, that's not that transformative. We've had wireless technology for a long time. We've had cameras for a long time.
Drone
technology for a long time. They've pulled it together in a way that might be beneficial. You can drive dozers 24/7 from all over the world, maybe cheaper labor, all those things, which again are good, but not transformational. And to really drive the point home, last thing I'll say on this is, if you think about how they actually had it hooked up, it was not impressive. And what I mean by that is, there was actually a guy in line in front of me, so I actually got in line and drove this thing, pretty fun. And I did a terrible job, by the way. It's clearly not my second career. But the guy in front of me did this professionally. He's a professional dozer driver. And he hops in the booth and he knows where all the joysticks and levers and buttons do and the screens do. And so they're like, all right, well, go do your first pass. And so he does this pass, you know, he's chugging along, clearly very confident, knows what he's doing. And they finish the pass and they're like, well, wait a minute. You didn't actually load up the blade at all. Like, there's no dirt on this. So he did this pass and didn't move any dirt at all, which is kind of the point of a dozer. And this is from some guy who does it professionally. And it occurred to me at that moment, what had happened is he's used to being in the real world where he has all these other inputs, whether it be the tactile feel of the machine that he's sitting in, the sound of the engine whirring. He'd probably have a different perspective of what it looks like when the dirt's flying up and the sound of that. None of that came through in this drone cockpit. He just had screens and cameras, and the cameras positioned sort of just like you'd see if you were sitting in the dozer, but you couldn't really see how deep that blade was, or was it even touching the dirt, which to me seemed insane. Like, again, it's a natural thing to do. Well, we have the people, they drive these things, let's recreate the environment they're used to. Very natural, iterative thing to do. But they missed the point. You now have cameras. You can't put the cockpit of a dozer down on the blade of a dozer. but you can put a camera down there. And you can't put a cockpit behind the thing because you wouldn't see where you're going, but you could put a camera there. Rather than like reimagining what this could be and what it would look like given these sort of new technology, they just did sort of the next incremental step. And while that's not bad, back to my point, it just felt very disappointing across the board. Did you guys see anything, by the way, in the news or anything like that, that you were impressed by, that I'm totally wrong?
No, I was just there for a day and I didn't see anything, really, earth shattering. But I think this goes back to the discussion we had last time Kevin was here around people, with the recession, having to batten down the hatches a little bit, and not just recession, with money being more expensive. Like we don't have free money to invest without, real limits. And so I think people are having to, like we said in that podcast, having to really prioritize what they look at and do things that will have somewhat immediate value, not things that are like, well, this is going to drive value 5-10 years from now. They need value right now.
But do you think that people understood that a year ago? So my point is, like, the past 2 years, the amount of VC money that's gone into tech in particular is astronomical. I mean, it's off the charts. There's so much money that's been spent over the past few years. We get to CES, which again should be sort of the latest, greatest R&D elements. And it's very, to your point, near-term focused, which if it were 6 months from now would make more sense to me, or a year from now would make more sense to me. But coming off this wave where we should have had massive innovation because we spent so much money in R&D, I didn't see it. And so I guess, like, if we rewind the tape, I don't remember people talking about it from a corporate strategic standpoint a year ago saying, hey, you need to watch your burn, you need to cut costs. So where did all that R&D money go? Or maybe, Erickson, you can tell me, like, if you were advising a CEO, would you have told them, hey, don't talk about that stuff? Like, it's fine, you guys invested the money, you did R&D, but in this arena now, you need to focus on the optics of what it would look like. And so spend your energy on incremental, really near-term, available to market versus sort of longer-term vision.
Well, before I think about what a CEO, I'd advise a CEO, I'm really left with two questions. So one is what is the target market for CES? I mean, I don't know how large the professional dozer driver group is and how much they impact who attends CES. And then secondly, I think our listeners are very interested in how much money did you guys lose in the craps tables, and how much was the amount of time that you spent actually at CES versus other diversions that you possibly could have done while you were
the answer to the second question is enough that I have a second job as a dozer driver now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the good news is for Credera, if you will, and our listeners, is that Jason on that first night made sure that I lost enough. I didn't really gamble anymore the rest of the time I was out there, so a little painful.
Yeah, that is good. It's interesting, these two examples, that they actually both hit home for me, and then I'll try to circle back, Vincent, to your question. Is so one, in my last Accenture gig, I was working for a mining company, so I think 2005, 2006, and we were helping with all their RC technology and had a chance to be in multiple mines, both underground and above, where they were using all this technology at that point. Nothing was being driven anymore. They were working 24/7, so you're talking now almost 20 years later. Maybe the location is different. You're not as close to where it is. You can run it around the world. But it's interesting that we're still seeing that as a kind of best case technology and how that plays out. And then similarly, the interfaces between your electronics, your refrigerator, and those elements have been around now for many years as well. In fact, Credera has helped one of our previous clients around how to do this probably now 6-7 years ago, we were building those interfaces. And so, I think maybe it begins, what is the purpose of CES and who is the audience? And how do we, maybe part of it is even the way that Apple has changed product launches that used to be the expense associated with the CES, the sizzle that you got from that potentially has changed. That could be one element that we could consider. I think that it's also, it's really a newsworthy event. I mean, I think you're seeing it's been so dominated by certain things. I mean, even I wasn't there, but some of the images that came out were, electric vehicles, launching those type of products that are years yet for market. And then if you think about what's that cycle, which I think maybe Vincent, what you're getting to is that, what's the lead time cycle to get to CES? When you drop that off, where do you do that? What's the cost associated with that? Mm-hmm. In a previous life, I helped a new startup company I was part of. We launched, did something at CES, and the only person that makes money at CES, in my opinion, is the people that put on CES. And so, right. So I think it's trying to think through that and what are the different ways that we can do that. But the broader question is like, what is innovation? You know, when, what is incremental growth versus, you know, groundbreaking, changing technologies? Where are we going to see that at? You know, is it going to be continued iteration? And I think those are really interesting questions for this season. You know, we don't quite know what 2023 is going to bring. We don't know from a company perspective, you know, how much it will be survival, how much will be retrenchment, how much it will be using this opportunity to position your companies for both really future growth, how that plays out between what you currently do versus where you innovate. And then, as Jason mentioned, you know, previous themes that we've discussed around how does innovation occur? I think we're seeing that right now with a lot of the return to work mandates that are associated with companies that are reducing headcount. Is that because they believe that innovation occurs more together? Is it a mechanism to help weed out people who don't want to come back to the office so they don't have to do layoffs or what that may look like? I'm sure there's truth for different companies on that, but I think we're going to have to continue to work through what is the next bit of iteration and innovation that's going to drive growth and how that plays out into the next step. So asking the question, what do we do? What do I advise? I think it goes back to trying to understand, first of all, where you're at for the company. How are you positioning yourself for the next 24 months? You know, where do you have to retrench? And then how do you continue to grow from there? And how do you make those investments that that hopefully will fuel the next bit of growth for your business versus just continuing to kick the can down the road?
It is interesting. You mentioned the, you know, not working together. It made me think of the, you know, Microsoft did a paper, was it last year?
Yeah.
And around remote work, and you know, they have a very large scale experiment, you know, of all the folks at Microsoft working remote. And you know, one of their findings was that the one thing that did suffer in that was creative and innovative work, that people not being together and had an impact on that. And I wonder if maybe there's some of that not impacting, you know, what it is. I do take the point of, yeah, well, people weren't thinking we needed to batten down the hatches, you know, 6-12 months ago, but I don't know that that's true. I think a lot of people were thinking that. I also think the point of, well, we need to highlight the innovations we have that have an immediate payback. Right now, to your point about like who are the audience, well, a lot of it is press and analysts, and you know, it's a way to get all your product launches without, you know, you're not everybody's Apple and can host a big product launch. And potential customers, right, you know, especially in the B2B space, you know, certainly attend that. And maybe there is an aspect of focusing on what we can sell right now. So maybe it's some combination of those three, maybe it's other things. But I do think that in general, for whatever of those three reasons or some other reasons, I do think people are really focused on the short term, like how do we drive value right now?
I think it's really good. And just to clarify one point there, one of the reasons that they said that innovation kind of suffered is sort of collaborative thinking and different opinions suffered during the lockdown is that what they saw when they looked at internal Microsoft as using that COVID moment of everybody working remotely now as a proxy is that people spent more time talking. And she said, well, that seems like a good thing. And that's true. That is a good thing. The mechanism they talked was a lot more in chat, a lot more sort of short form communication, not long form, not a lot of meetings, not as much video initially. But the real issue is that the number of people they talked to decreased significantly. So they talked more often to the same number of small audiences, and they didn't get the sort of outside thinking that they would have been exposed to in the office. And again, they did this by looking at internal Microsoft people, looking at their calendars, looking at where they met with, who they talked to, et cetera. So again, take it with a grain of salt. It's not, you know, global in nature of that study, but like at least for that organization, that was true. And so that is one thing that occurred to me. The other thing that occurred to me that we haven't talked on yet, which you alluded to, Kevin, is that with all of the money that went into tech over the past few years, those people have been spending like crazy to acquire new talent. So you could reasonably argue that the vast majority of top talent was acquired and held captive by a few tech companies, because they were just willing to pay basically infinity dollars for those people. What we will see now, I suspect, and what we've seen in the previous recessions, is that those top companies are not willing to pay the premium they used to. In fact, they're going to lay people off. They're going to let some of them go. Some of those amazing people will, of course, stay, but a lot of them will be available in the market to help these other companies grow. And so to the extent that you need really top talent, amazing caliber people to help innovate and do the next generation of ideas, thinking outside the box conceptually, I think that now is the time that, that a lot of new ideas might come to fruition. Which then leads me to this question that you said, which is like, are these large companies doing the right thing by letting people go? And I think the answer is yes, they have to, just from a free cash flow. I mean, most, by the way, just remember, most of the large, call them FANG companies as a proxy for tech in general, most of the FANG companies more than doubled their staff over the past 2 years. You're talking about doubling your entire staff over 2 years. You have to believe there's some extra inefficiencies that come from places like that when you grow that quickly. And so they're going to cut, and they're going to continue to cut, is my intuition, as I've predicted in the past. And, you know, Jason and I have historically been on slightly different sides. I'm a bit more pessimistic than he is. But my question to you, Kevin, then is, again, from a strategy standpoint, how do you ensure that when you're doing these cuts, you keep the top people that you really want to keep and let some of the weaker performers, those who hadn't really figured out how to fit into that org, that culture, that whatever, go? To your point, we've seen people do these things where you need to come back to the offices. Elon Musk, of course, is the most infamous for doing this. You need to show up. You need to work super hard. You need to be all in. As TK, my former CEO, would have said, you have to be super pumped. And if you're not, then get out, right? How do you do that? I certainly believe that saying come to the office N days a week, whatever N is, depending on your company, will end up with some selection bias. But is it the right selection bias? Or do you end up just with people who can't get a job that's fully remote? I don't know. Like, how do you think about that? Or how do you control for that? Or, you know, like, how do you deal with that, I guess?
Yeah, I think it might take a slightly different spin. It really starts to become around a question of culture. And what do you want to have? What do you want talent you want to look like? You know, there's even going back to the previous 2 years where you've seen such growth, you know, in some ways, and this is a very simplistic way to look at tech companies. But if you think about, you know, most technology companies are greatly influenced by the concept of Moore's Law and continued growth, how fast it is. You've got a hungry, hungry hippo scenario with talent. You know, I think a lot of the last 2 years was, we are just going to grab whatever talent we possibly can to make sure we have it. So we control that talent, whether it be for innovation, whether it be for resources. And now what you're seeing is, what do you do with that talent? And which was really the question for this topic for today, which is, how do you sort through that? How do you work through that? Do you take, you know, the classic consulting approach where whoever's busy gets sticks around, whoever's not gets let go? You know, do you sort through who's the ones that want to work and collaborate the harder? Do you sort through those that are smart and impactful? I would argue that there's always been hybrid work. There's always been remote work if you are talented enough to have done that, to provide enough value for your company to be able to achieve that. So that is nothing new. I think it was open to more people during COVID, so they got a taste of that. And so I think one of the questions now for how your product and technology leaders work with your accountants and lawyers and HR resources is going to be, how do you give people opportunities and sort through that? What does that look like in today's time where there's different considerations in how we also assess talent? I think, since I would imagine that most of our listeners are more on the technical and product side, are thinking about impact. I mean, I think you have to fight for those that you think either have the greatest impact or the most potential, or going to help fit in with your team. In this sense, I would argue that are going to have contrarian perspectives, are going to want to work you grow, are going to want you to have more debate and dialogue. All these things that help things, people and companies grow in times of tension. We haven't had to do that a lot over the last 2 years. And I think that this is where I think the opportunity is going to really open up for other companies to look for talent and to really help go back to what your core values are and what do you want to value the growth of your business on, and how do you grow and nurture and give opportunities to hungry individuals at different degrees of talent and experience and be able to create that. And I think the companies that work towards that are going to be able to find this a very rich opportunity to be able to add talent. Now, the challenge is, what do you do with those that aren't meeting the bar, and how do you work through that? And how do you do that in a way that is sensitive and culturally aligned to what your vision and values are? And I think that's what's going to be really interesting over the next year or so, to see how that plays out. I think you have an older, this is maybe a bit of my, I'll join the pessimistic camp here for a second in terms of employee contribution. I also think that there has been elements of this last 2.5 years that, in a negative sense, the employees have kind of brought this upon ourselves. Did you work hard when you were remote? Were you always on? Were you doing multiple jobs? Were you, you know, to your point, talking to a lot of colleagues, but not about work, working through that? And I think that you know, my hypothesis would be that some of those themes are coming home now, and it's not necessarily a free lunch, to use a management consultant's perspective and how that works out. And you look at the alternatives, which is greater employee spying, monitoring, those elements, those are unsavory. And so I think, you know, companies are asking themselves, how do we make sure that the majority of our talent is contributing a fair share? I don't have to worry about the high performers. That'll be obvious. Wherever they work, wherever you see it, you're going to see that impact. And those are the ones you probably also are not having to ask to come back into the office or to find moments where they can collaborate at CES or other locations. It's going to be really the rank and file, and how do you, you know, sort through that and work through that. And there's not two or three silver bullets, but I think it comes back to culture and character. Those are themes that are everlasting, but are also a bit under attack right now.
You know, I also think that constraints are good, right? You know, this is something we've talked about before. You know, when you see big innovations, there's usually some constraints. We talked about it in response to the metaverse, right? You know, it's $25 billion or whatever that Meta is spending a year. Like, would they actually get better results if they spent a lot less, right? You know, the stereotype of the Silicon Valley startup is in the basement eating ramen, you know, working on a shoestring. And
I think it's usually a garage, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. Basement, garage, whatever.
Could they stake Jason at the CS tables too? You know,
yes, exactly.
Frank Smith. I mean, I think that would be also that's an interesting bet for us to talk about.
That's a losing bet for sure. But you know, I think that again, in the age of the last, you know, few years of totally free money, it was again, like you said, grow and spend money on everything and spend a lot of money on everything. And some things like Stadia come to mind, right? And it's like, well, at some point when we have constraints, we have to look at like, well, is this really, you know, our core mission? You know, we only have so much money to make so many bets. Like, are we going to be able to, we're not able to make all the bets we want anymore. We're going to have to focus. And I think that's where a lot of these cuts will come from. And it would be great if it were all based on performance, but you know, it usually happens that it's based on this area or set of bets that we're going. Now, what I think can happen is then the great talent in those areas can go off and you know, start to use Stadia, for example, a new game company, right? And that's where I think you will see a lot of the innovation going forward is in some of these smaller cuts where some of these really high performers that were just in business units or on bets that were not, you know, that were not decided to continue on, will go and continue and follow their passion, right? And so again, some companies may be able to keep all the high performers, but I think it's generally much more peanut butter than that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. And I think the thing I want to like circle back to that you said, Eric, so I'm going to see a few points, but the first one is, you know, during this moment of boom over the past couple of years, really, they were doing this hungry, hungry hippo game, right? Where they're just trying to buy up all the talent they possibly can. From a strategic standpoint, would you say that was actually a good move? Like, in other words, would you say that these big FANG tech companies were buying talent because they really knew what to do with that talent and how to deploy it? Or were they doing it so that their competitors didn't get it? And is that like the right move to do? Sort of, you know, I think back to poker when you're playing tournament games. When you're the big stack, you have the most chips at the table. You should play a very different style where you're kind of bullying people around. You're not always making the most conservative bets. You're actually playing pretty aggressively because you can afford to lose quite a few. And the chance that you knock somebody else out is actually decent at that time. And so you play just very differently. Is that what we saw over the past couple of years, do you think?
Yeah, I think, I mean, just to be blunt, I mean, I think it's an interesting element of you referenced the FANG companies and the large ones that make that, you know, they're now 20 to 25, 30 years into their existence. And so it's not 2000 anymore. And you look at who are their models? Are they looking at their 1995 cells or are they looking at the 1995 version of GM? I mean, you look at who are their comparables of how they run, how do the mature organizations work? I mean, you think about the change that Tesla has caused the automotive industry. Would the automotive firms done that if Tesla wouldn't have come in and worked through that? So I think that's a bit of what you saw with technology. For them, they are being, I think, looking for talent, looking for new new ideas, but also being very, shrewd business operators on how to shore up their flanks a bit. And I think what's going to be really intriguing is how does new ideas, new technologies emerge? What's the difference between a product company and a technology company? I mean, is there a difference? How does that play out? I mean, I think that's intriguing to me today too, is that, how do the big technology companies ultimately make their money? Where does it work through that? So where is the technical innovation that supports that versus where is that marketing and customer experience and those other themes? And so I think it's going to be a real interesting question on where does innovation come? Where does that play? Clearly, elements of climate and fossils are a big area where we see that today. Data is a big area where you see that. Automation is a big area where you see that. But what is that next frontier that's going to propel the next set of growth? I mean, this forum has asked a lot of questions around metaverse or Web3, what that looks like. Will it be there? Is it going to be in others? I mean, I think that's a lot of what we're looking at right now. How does just globalization, in this interesting world from a geopolitical perspective? So, more questions than answers, but I do think that is, you see mature, large players protecting their market share through acquisition, and that it's by both company and talent. And so now we're going to need to see what happens from that. And, even thinking about the whole structural, at least in the U.S., how education plays and how that plays out. And I think that's going to be an intriguing place to continue to see where do we still use the same prescriptive models of education up through K-12, the college experience, to where is it going to be, the Googles of the world continuing to have their own academies and develop talent themselves. And I think that it's going to be fascinating in the next 5 to 10 years how that plays out. And then for the other companies around that ecosystem, how do you play and how do you work through that? And I think it's a great opportunity for you to look at talent that's coming from those big factories, very similar to our business when, most smaller consulting firms got their original resources from larger consulting firms that went through the training. I think if you're a technology firm looking to hire talent, looking for people that want to move faster, have greater growth curve, maybe don't have to work on the most absolute cutting edge, but want to have an innovative idea, it's going to be a great way for companies to go and sort talent. So, I mean, in some ways, your executive recruiting could be simply looking at 3 or 4 major companies and how you poach from them.
It's a really interesting point I hadn't actually contemplated before, which is that these big tech companies that have transformed so much of technology and how we work today are using the same management styles effectively of the era that they grew up in. So the, AT&T Bell Labs or IBM or GM, where they build these huge campuses, pull everybody there, even the Microsofts, right? Like that was Microsoft's big deal, was to pull everybody there. Now, to your point earlier, for exceptional talent, they would let you be anywhere. They never really cared. If you're amazing and can deliver value, they don't really care where you are. But for the majority of people, you need to be in person. With the opportunity to save on real estate costs, which of course gone through the roof recently, the desire from a huge number of people who had never experienced remote work who now want to do it, I wonder if there is now room for some companies to innovate. Like, what does a management style look like if you're fully remote? And no doubt some companies have been doing this for a long time, to your other point, right? Like Atlassian and Shopify have been remote fully for, since their inception effectively. And they were, arguably pretty good. But it's not the majority, it's definitely the minority, and there's maybe room to innovate in that space. And what that looks like then, I don't know, but it is a fascinating point.
Yeah. Well, we're just asking a question, but I think about this theme a lot because I think I feel like there's almost going to be polarization on the two sides of the equation, with there'll be some that kind of can find something in the gooey middle, but I think you're going to see people back in the offices, and that's going to be where the primary, whether N is 3 days, 4 days, whatever that might look like. I think you're going to find other companies that really do find a way to work through that and continue to go back to education, because it's a passion area of mine. I think it's interesting looking at the hybrid schools that have used some form of at-pace home-based learning with getting on campus together a certain number of days as a really interesting way to craft experiences that allow people to work well and thrive in those environments where they have a chance to work independently. But then also there's set moments. And so I can see real estate campuses looking very different. I can see companies that have a dispersed workforce that aren't in the same geographic area, choosing to fly people in and working through that. And so I think there will be room for innovation. And I think that's the key thing is that for companies to choose, what they want to do. I mean, it's not lost on me that a lot of the executives and it's that have come back to work campuses also grew up in the era where all their employees were in their buildings. And so How much are they being influenced? This is what they did. This is how they weathered the previous storms that happened in the first half or two thirds of their careers. I mean, I don't think we'll know. I'm sure every story is slightly different. You know, I think, you know, then you have interesting, I think Disney's an interesting company because they have so many different business units. So it's hard to say, well, hey, you know, we've got our entertainment, park and entertainment business. They're all in front of our customers every single day. All our other employees should be that. I mean, it's too simplistic to say that because they obviously make money in a lot of different products in a lot of different areas where they don't have that experience. But I think that the key is going to be for companies to make an intentional choice going into 2023 and try to live and work through that and then help your client, help your teammates and your employees work through the implications of that choice. Because what's not going to happen is that I think right now and for the last 2 years, white collar employees could call the ball. They could do whatever they wanted and they had the authority, and you're seeing that switch back where there's going to be a bit more switching costs involved with an employee. Yes, they can find a job that's fully remote. They can find a job that's fully in person. Those exist. You may not be able to find that where they're at today, and they're going to have to live with that consequence.
Yeah, it's really good. I do think that, you know, my personal favorite management style, if you will, is to manage by walking around, right? Like that was my favorite thing. I just loved walking around, seeing what the team was up to, what was on the screen, asking random questions, seeing the dynamics. It gave me an insight that I've never been able to figure out how to do remotely. I mean, you can ask questions like, what are you working on? And, you know, it's often text-based and asynchronous, so they have a lot of time to think about how to respond to that question. And you don't get sort of the gut, visceral reaction that you hear the pensive nature, the tentative nature, the confidence in their voice that tells you something that is different. And so no doubt I think management teams across the world will need to relearn or learn for the first time actually some skills that accommodate that. And I think we've seen attempts through monitoring software and employee spying, if you want to use the negative pejorative phrasing of that, to figure out like, well, how do I tell who's working, what's happening, are they being productive, et cetera. But that's always been true, right, Jason? I mean, we've seen lots of companies try and do things like, well, how many commits did you do? Or how many bugs were in your code? Or other sort of empirical metrics to measure productivity, even when we were in person.
Yeah, velocity, all kinds of things. And I generally am not a big fan of those. I think that is somewhat after the fact, right? It's too late, right? By the time you get those reports at the end of the month to do anything about it. But I do think management by walking around, I've always loved that phrase, but it is helpful. I mean, especially in our business consulting and working with our clients. You know, I was in Denver recently. I'm going to be in Chicago this week. And just as you go around, you know, not only just meet people, like, you know, I see someone, we're working on something. Hey, how are you doing? What are you working on? Get to know them, understand a little bit what they're doing, you know, maybe offer some advice like, oh, think about this or whatever. But in the purely virtual world, I might not even know that person was, you know, was an employee in Chicago. And I certainly wouldn't like be reaching out to them and like, hey, what are you working on? I mean, I don't know they're there. So there's some of that I think you can't replicate. I may take a slight tangent though. And since this is technology tangents, this may
any
be
a
tangent.
Whether it be mathematical or conceptual.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we talked about innovation. We talked about ways of working and where people are and how they work. But one of the things I wanted to quickly talk on was like what they work on. And, you know, we tend to focus on innovation, new things. How do we make money? Especially in these you know, times where things are tough. Yeah, we've got to get stuff that gets like immediate return. And one of the things that often gets ignored is some of the investment in, you know, I'll use the term tech debt. We did a pod on tech debt and what that is. And oftentimes very, you know, no one is very interested in doing that, right? Because it doesn't have some type of immediate payback. But I think there's a real risk in that, right? Which is if you continue to add to it and now, you know, the tech debt and you've got fewer people, you spend all your resources servicing the debt. And I think HP was real famous for this. They had a study where they looked at like every dollar spent, like less than 5 cents, less than 5% went to actually developing anything new because everyone spent all their time working on the debt. And so they just made a rule they were going to spend something like 30% of their resources paying down that debt, right? Fixing things that were broken, automating things, that kind of stuff. Well, over time, that jumped up the amount of new innovation they got to something like 40 cents on the dollar, right? Which is eight times what they were getting, right? In terms of throughput, in terms of new investment. And so, again, I would really counsel people to think through, like, hey, we can't just spend, we still have to spend time paying down some of these, like, tech debt or.
I think that makes sense. I think that the challenge is, like, how do you do that from an incentive structure, especially with shareholder primacy that's really taken the front stage over the past few years? You need to drive incremental revenue, incremental profit.
Oh, it's not easy. And let me, that was when I was like, in fact, my assertion is no one's going to do it, right? And well, so, but my point is, like, hey, I think the people that are able to do some of it, like, will be in a better spot when things start turning around.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I agree that it's hard to get the institutional energy behind that, but a little free consulting for our listeners here, the way that I'd be restructuring all the tech debt conversations around compliance and risk of litigation and having your data get out, right? If you couch all those activities around the risk associated with data privacy, loss, breach, those elements, the money's going to be there. Now, how much that's true, how far you can get through that, but that would be probably what I'd be telling my board and working through my shareholders on. But then, in the same token, as I say that, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, it just drives me nuts because we end up continuing to spend money not on innovation, not on growth. We're spending our money and our resources simply trying to protect ourselves from really or from threats that have nothing to do with competitive threats, which is a challenge. I mean, again, you think about what's the next wave of growth and innovation for really society. If you're solely concerned about other elements of bureaucracy and everything else that's going to come down, like, that's going to be really challenging how we work through that. But
I think it is a competitive right. You know, Andreessen's famous for saying software's eating the world. Like, the ability to deal with competitive threats is your ability to deliver software fast. In many, many industries, right? And
well, so I think that's true if you're a large enterprise customer. I guess, like, this is how I would differentiate the two. I think they're both statements are true. If I'm a large enterprise Fortune 500 company, what I would want to do if I were a CEO and I were in charge of the world and I could do everything I wanted, what I would do is really say to my team, you need to pay down tech debt, because here's what I'm going to measure you on. I'm going to measure you on all the risk, no doubt. But more importantly, to your point, Jason, I'm going to measure you on how quickly new technology can be implemented when it's proven to be valuable. So for example, ChatGPT, very popular right now. Lots of people are talking to it. We've been working on this for a little bit. And the question is, how quickly could you integrate that to your systems? And if you have a lot of tech debt, the answer is, I don't know, 6, 12, 18 months. We have one client that, like, I pitched this to them 6 months ago now, and they loved it. And they're like, but talk to us in 2024. Other clients are like, I'm just talking to them now. And like, great, let's try next month. Right. And so I think, like, that comes down to, if you're a large company, you have to be ready to sort of absorb and integrate the new novel technology. The flip of that is, if you're a small company, I think you have to innovate that growth yourself. And so maybe you take a more risk seeking profile. You say, fine, I'm willing to take the risk. If, like, somebody sues us, we go bankrupt. I mean, that's a risk, and that might happen. That would suck. But, like, that's the risk we're willing to accept in order to your point, be able to grow really quickly and focus on innovation and not anything. Because I'm not going to, the answer is, like, if I'm a small company, integrating the latest greatest technology, it's not going to make me the next Fortune 100 company. It's really, like, innovating and truly growing from that standpoint.
But again, I would even, I agree, right, with the comments about the, you know, the Fortune 500 companies. But I would say even those small companies, the ones that become successful are the ones that can innovate quickly by not having a bunch of, you know, what they have going for them is that they don't have any of that legacy tech debt, right? They're so new.
No, I totally agree. And I think that you're exactly right. They sort of get free tech debt because they're, by the nature of being a relatively new company, they don't have a lot. The other thing I'd say, though, is to the risk point, I mean, it feels prescient, because back in January, right, we saw a major airline have, or I guess it was actually December, we saw the airline have major problems because of a legacy system. More recently, we've seen the FAA have a major problem with their legacy system. And these are systems that are core to the business that were built. I don't know, Jason, you probably built these systems when you were, like, you know, a young green bean. And they're so critical. There's so many integration points, so many of the systems have been built on top and around them that ripping those out or trying to redo them is incredibly difficult with incredible risk associated with it at this point. It feels like you end up in the space where it's fragile by design almost at this point. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Well, everyone talks about some of these recent outages, and they, you know, the universal like response that you see from, you know, pundits and analysts and in the media is that, well, they need to upgrade those systems, right? And I tend to think a little differently. Like, well, you upgrade it and then what? Another 40 years goes by and it causes other big, like, you don't need to upgrade it. You need the ability to stay upgraded and stay on top of these things and continue to evolve and patch, whether it be security or automate, whether it's the FAA outage was because of a manual error, right? So automate testing. You need to continue to do these things and stay on top of it. Not like wait, you know, it's like anything else. Like, well, do you want to change your oil every 3,000 miles or you want to wait till the car to break down? Right. Well, it's way more expensive and impactful if you wait for it to break down over the long run. But again, to your point, Kevin, it's going to be really hard to convince companies of this when they're, you know, treading water and like looking to drive out, like we need a little bit more EBIT this quarter. Right. And so I think the ones that are able to figure out how to do it and still get some value, you know, which may mean really focusing on both a small set of innovations or improvements and some of this, will be much better off again when things turn around to be able to grow faster.
Well, this is where I think is, and it could be an interesting, you know, just interesting bit of our time. You know, think about where companies are going to grow, and you know, we have this always on culture. And so it's easy to be a pundit on an airline when you can see what happened and you know the solution. And I think the fact that every single day I know the stats of my product, I know how many customers I have, all these different elements of where we're at today, that is, if you're a CEO and you're trying to keep your job, like it really is on you. You always have to be focused on specifically what's going to drive revenue and value. So these investments, whether it be in future growth or in fixing, you know, the foundation of your business aren't in vogue anymore. And so, I don't think that's going to change for public companies in particular, but it might create opportunities for smaller companies, for more private companies where they can make those investments in different ways. I think I'm intrigued. There's tons of dry powder right now in venture capital and where they do it, what they do with it. As cost of capital goes, will they start finding more innovative companies to use that, to give them longer times to be able to monetize that, having different approaches? And so, through every hard season, and we know this, we've been around for a long time, right? Every hard season creates new opportunities for those that want to go after it. And I think we've been in this unsteady ground of, are we in a bad spot or are we in a good spot? Is it COVID related or something changed? Is it this or is it that? Yeah, and I think that the companies that, you know, I think have great 2023s are going to be the ones that are going to be like, we don't know the answer to that question, but we're going to create a strategy. We're going to move forward. And I think that that's what you're starting to see. I think you'll start to, I think it is easier to do that in smaller companies and ones that have greater autonomy to make those investments. And so that's, again, going back to the themes of what do you do with talent? If you're growing, how do you look for that? There's probably going to be some buying opportunities where you'll have carve outs. I mean, I think the big technology companies are going to be looking to shed products and divisions and how that plays out. So that's going to be an interesting opportunity. So I'm intrigued by a lot of our themes that we discussed today, just around how this plays out. And maybe to have my own tangent of a tangent of a tangent, I think it's going back to maybe, you know, Vince, even how you started us today, which is around what is the experience of driving a cat, whether you be at a construction site, a mining site, whether you be at a, you know, driving in, you know, the farm. What I'm intrigued about all those things is that we miss something, whether it be in that experience, whether it be walking the halls, we miss the emotion, the connection, the energy that happens through the senses. And I think that that's one of the things that you can't replicate on a screen. You can't replicate if you're driving a cat from half a country away. You don't get the sense of the smells and the feeling and the bumps and the bruises. And yes, and we can continue to add technology to try to enhance that. And I think that's what's going to be intriguing for this year for management. How do you want to work through that? How do you want to do that with your employees, with your customers, and You know, one of the things I always felt it was really cool about CES, outside of more of the press sizzle reel of it, was it's an opportunity to engage. It's an opportunity for you to go and entertain. It's an opportunity, you know, to really kind of connect with your customers through the mechanism of having some fun. And I think it's going to be important for us to remember how we do that in ways that are unique to our companies and how we grow. So I am pessimistic in some things, I'm optimistic in others, but you know, I think what's kind of cool is that every day we just have to go after it and see where it takes us.
I think it's great advice. Just pick a strategy. You got to go after it. Don't get stuck in analysis paralysis. I just wanted to follow up with one last point. You know, again, if you think about this idea that we've seen a lot of data breaches, we've seen a lot of ways that you could sort of use that risk as real. I mean, we saw Equifax with $500 million, $575 million at least, of fees for a data breach. We saw Amazon last year with $877 million fees for the data breach. You know, it's not just the U.S. DD, for example, $1.2 billion for data breach fees. So like, these costs are real. They're certainly going to have an impact on your share price. And I think if you just remember, like, this is a real thing, it's going to have massive impact, not only on the risk side, but to your point, Jason, on the innovation side. Focus on it, do it, prioritize it. But I like the idea, look, choose a strategy, whether you choose, you know, in person, hybrid, fully remote, whether it be we're going to try and grow our way out of this, we're going to retrench and just cut costs and try and survive this. Pick something, yeah. Choose it, and then do your best to really innovate around that set of constraints.
One thing is not to take us back in, but as I was one of the many travelers that had my holiday plans somewhat disrupted by an airline, I found myself, as I saw them, how they reacted working through that, is what were they more concerned about? Were they concerned about short-term revenue loss? Were they concerned about long-term customer erosion? Or were they concerned about the fact that they were trying to outrun tort lawyers in the government? And I think that that's an interesting element of, like, what's the real risk for a company today? And I would say that it's not always your customers or customer loss. They'll be able to get customers back faster than some of those elements. And maybe that's always been there. And that's nothing new today, but it is a different calculus that I think companies have to explore today.
Really interesting.
Yeah, that may be the subject for another podcast, because I think it's a really interesting point. It's amazing to me how many tangents we can hit based starting from the point of me losing a lot of money in crafts.
Awesome. Well, thank you both for joining me today. I really appreciate it. A great conversation. I had fun. I hope you did too, listeners. For those of you who would like to learn more, please visit the insights page at Credera.com. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us again.
Thanks, everyone.